All right, I'd like you to take your Bible this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here is Ted Weiland.
All right, this will be non-optional leadership, part four. Let's take our Bibles and turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3. When you hear the word, we're talking about leadership, and so when you hear the word leader, what do you think of? What, or maybe I should ask, who comes to mind? Well, I got to thinking this week that, you know, if you're not a Christian, unless you're involved in some company or corporation with some exceptional bosses or supervisors, that without that, as a non-Christian, you probably have only bad, really bad, examples of leadership in this day and age to reflect upon. Men like Obama, or the Bushes, in fact, or Clinton, and the scoundrels that we have in Congress today. But I also, in my reflecting upon that, I realize that, as always, all things work together for good, and everything goes wrong just right. And therefore, there even in that, as we look at least on the from a national scale or a government perspective, that there's in this day and age it seems especially that there's very few, if any, really, really exceptional examples of leaders. There's still a silver lining in this. Even what you could say is good news to be found in this lack of poor leadership in the United States' current batch of scoundrels. If nothing else, they provide the impetus for Americans to look elsewhere for their leadership, and which is but an opportunity for pronomian, kingdom now, dominion-oriented Christians to provide the alternatives and thereby provide some hope that is so desperately needed in this day and age for something better than what America has to offer today, which, considering America's current batch of leaders, doesn't really even present much of a challenge. That is, for something merely better than what we have today. there's an opening for us, if our people will walk through it, to take another step forward in Christian dominion. Listen, the non-Christian world, in addition to their lousy leadership, is itself providing us with that opportunity in at least two different ways. First, by the fact that they are the people who are killing their posterity via or by way of infanticide, which puts an entirely different perspective on infanticide than I think most people tend to think of it. It doesn't change the fact that infanticide is murder. But if you think about it, in his sovereignty, Yahweh is unquestionably using their wickedness against themselves. Again, it's not our people who are killing their children, their posterity. It's their people, and he's using, I believe he's using that. In fact, I know he's sovereign. It's in his control. There's got to be, beyond a reason other than just their murderers, that God is allowing for this to happen. And in fact, I believe he is, in fact, using their wickedness against them, and in so doing, opening an opportunity for our posterity to fill what will be future leadership openings in a number of different places and ways. Secondly, the fact that America's current quote-unquote educational system is dumbing down the children the non-Christians let live is another means by which even that, or that we can talk about a silver lining in all of this. Whereas generally speaking, Christian homeschooling parents are actually educating their children while at the same time providing ethics and morality and wisdom training, that regardless the leadership position, whether in government or whether in the business or the workplace, people are looking for those positions. Even those who themselves may not be particularly moral want their leaders to be moral and wise. Kind of ironic, you know, the majority of the world could care less about morality, but they want their leaders to be moral and they want them to be wise. And not just educated, they want them to be wise. Parents, it's much more important that you provide your children with wisdom than education. If for no other reason than we're witnessing today what knowledge without wisdom produces. Of course, even the knowledge that's being provided, the education that's being provided, is often not what we would or what God would intend that they receive in the first place. But even if it is, knowledge without wisdom, we can see what it produces. I can assure you that your children are not going to be provided wisdom in the public school system. Where then is wisdom training to be found? Well, how about Proverbs? I think there's some wisdom, a lot of wisdom to be found in Proverbs, and particularly by instilling Yahweh's laws within our children. And that's right, in addition to everything else that Yahweh's laws provide us, Yah's laws are one of the principal means of obtaining wisdom, not just an education in God's morality, but in fact wisdom. Psalms 119, verses 98 through 100 says the following. It says, "Thou, through thy commandments, hast made me wiser than mine enemies." And let me tell you, if there's somebody you want to be wiser than, it's your enemies. And God says, listen, go to my commandments. And of course, there are statutes and judgments that are integral to them. And I will make you wiser, not just educated, but wiser than your enemies. He says, "For they are ever with me." Well, let me read it again. It says, Thou through thy commandments has made me wiser than mine enemies, for they, his commandments, are ever with me. I have more understanding than all of my teachers, for thy testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients, because I have kept thy precepts. Both wisdom and understanding comes through the integration of Yahweh's laws into our lives. Today's antinomians need to wake up to the fact that because they are not training their children in Yahweh's laws, that their children, even though they may claim Christ as Lord and Savior, even though they may follow him in a number of different ways, because they are not teaching Yahweh's laws to their children, that their children are not going to be hardly any different than the non-Christians' children when it comes to wisdom and knowledge. Pronomians, take that to heart. Knowing that Yahweh's laws are for today is not enough. Fathers, you need to be training your children in Yahweh's laws and thereby preparing your sons to hope, and hopefully grandsons and great-grandsons, to be the next generation's leaders. Of course, you need to also be living yourself and teaching your sons the other leadership qualifications and qualities as well, and thus at least part of the reason for this series. With that in mind then, let's return to 1 Timothy chapter 3. I pointed out in the previous message that Yahweh begins his leadership qualifications with the requirement that leaders must, above and beyond everything else, be blameless. That is above reproach, a man who lives his life in such a way that he as to give no grounds for accusation, at least justified accusation. And can you imagine? God starts out his qualifications, the very first one, with blameless. Can you imagine if that were a requirement today before a man can toss his hat into the ring? We wouldn't have elections. That's really what it would amount to. In Titus 1, where Paul provides many of these same qualifications a second time, he actually mentions the word blameless twice. Let's turn to Titus, in fact. Keep your place there in 1 Timothy. Turn to Titus chapter 1, where we find a similar list to the one in 1 Timothy, maybe not quite as complete, but some of the same characteristics. And as I just said, here we find that Paul mentions blameless, so important that he mentions it twice. Titus chapter 1, let's begin reading with verse 5. It says, "For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldest set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city." I want you to note something there, particularly as it concerns what we dealt with, I think, in a couple messages back, and that I think the churches have had a wrong, or at least a minimized concept of elders in just a church setting. Notice he didn't say that, "Titus, I want you to set up elders in every church." He said in every city. Now, that could be indicative in those times, though I doubt it, that everybody was unified in harmony in all that they believed. But he said, "I want them set up in each city." I think that is reflective of the fact that the elders, the bishops, the overseers, the judges, were such in a much greater capacity than just in some little local church. It was a community, societal idea. It had to do with taking dominion and applying God's laws in every fact of society, and that God intends his leaders and his people to rule society. Well, a little bit more on that as we get a little bit further into this. But do note that it's in every city. I never had noticed that before until this morning's reading of this again. Again, verse 5, "For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldest set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city as I had appointed thee." Verse 6, "If any be blameless," starts off with this very same qualification, "the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly." Verse 7, "For a bishop must be blameless." So he says it twice, as the steward of God, and we can stop there. Titus chapter 1 and verse 6 in the Amplified puts it this way. It says, "These elders should be men who are of unquestionable integrity and are irreproachable." End of that quote. Again, for that being the first and primary quality for leaders today, but of course it's not. The key, or at least one of them, to such blamelessness, I believe, is found here in Titus 1 in verse 7, where again it says, "For the bishop must be blameless as the steward of God." 1 Thessalonians 2:10 through 12, I believe, presents the same idea. And it says this, it says, "You are witnesses, and God also, how holily and justly," New American Standard says devoutly and uprightly. King James continues, "and unblameably, blameless," New American Standard, We behaved ourselves among you that believe, as you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father doth his children. Verse 12, here it is, that you would walk worthy of God, who has called you into his kingdom and glory. I believe that's the concept. That's the key, at least one of the principal keys to how we walk blameless, that we do it so as to be worthy of God. It's the same idea expressed by King Jehoshaphat to those he appointed as judges in 2 Chronicles 19:5 through 9. We've read it before, but consider it in light of that, light of this point. Again, it says that he, Jehoshaphat, set judges, men who were elders, in the land throughout all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city. Same as Timothy was to do. Again, I think we're talking about the same thing in both passages, although it's specifying specifically judges in 2 Chronicles 19. They were the elders who were set into those positions. The elders in Timothy, I don't think are any that there's any less of a point to be made from the elders in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus 1, that this is what God intended, and it was to be done city by city, just as it was here. Again, it says, and he set judges in the land through all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, take heed what ye do, here it is, for you judge not for man, unlike those today, but for Yahweh, who is with you in judgment. End of quote. He says, judge not for man, judge, serve for Yahweh. In other words, as stewards of God. If you desire to live blamelessly, and if you're a Christian, that's non-optional, as was verified from the scriptures in the last message. We're not talking about just elder qualifications here. It's not as if Yahweh left us to choose to live blamelessly or not to live blamelessly. Oh, well, I don't intend to be a leader, so I guess I'll just choose to live non-blamelessly. God doesn't leave us with that choice. And if it's your objective to live blamelessly, really synonymous with to live as a Christian, don't, here's the point, don't live your life for yourself. That's probably a surefire recipe for defeat or for failure. Live your life with a much higher, the much greater objective as stewards, as another word you might replace with that, as ambassadors of Yahweh, the great I Am, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, and all that He is. It's basically the same thought we find in Romans chapter 14 and verses 7 and 8. For it says, none of us lives to himself, talking about us who are the stewards and ambassadors of Yahweh. None of us lives, at least we're not supposed to be. None of us lives. I mean, it was so much a fact that Paul didn't even allow for exception. He says, none of us live for ourselves. None of us dies for ourselves. For he who lives, lives for the Lord, and he who dies, dies for the Lord. For we are the Lord's, whether we live or die. That's the point. None of us live or dies. Once we are his, once we've surrendered our lives, no longer do we live for ourselves. We live for him as his stewards. The point being, you are much more likely to live blamelessly, which is pretty huge, if you live your life for him rather than for yourself. In other words, the higher the objective, the more exceptional are likely the results. And so instead of saying, I'm going to do it on my own here, I'm going to live blamelessly. No, you live blamelessly as a steward, as an ambassador, as a representative, as a son, as a daughter of Yahweh. Titus 1:7 again says that a bishop or an elder must be blameless as a steward, of Yahweh. Now, I think you'll find the Greek word from which steward is translated enlightening. I sure did. I had never looked it up before. Steward is translated from the Greek word oikonomos. Oikonomos, derived from the two words oikos and nomos. Does one of those sound familiar? I would hope, at least those of you who have heard me preach for some time now, that the word nomos or nomia would be familiar. It's the Greek word from which the English word law is derived. And thus we talk about antinomians and pronomians. Pronomians being those who are pro Yahweh's laws under the new covenant in the way that God intends them to be applied and used. And the antinomian, of course, is just the opposite. Antinomian, anti-law. Consequently, the steward, that is the elder, the bishop, the overseer, the judge, and Timothy and Titus, literally refers to a man who carries out his Lord's law. And we understand it that way. That's what a steward does. Whoever his Lord is, it's his responsibility to carry out his Lord's will, and thus his Lord's laws. And thus the steward in these cases is a man who carries out his Lord's laws, which is but another indication, I believe, that Paul is referring to more than what is usually thought of as the elders in today's churches. It is also indicative of another qualification often overlooked when it comes to elders, bishops, overseers, and judges under the new covenant, and that is that one must be, therefore, pronomian, actively pronomian, one who carries out his Lord's laws. Consequently, any quote-unquote pastor, elder, bishop, overseer, whatever you call him in today's churches, who is antinomian, is unqualified and should step down or be removed. He doesn't qualify because a part of being blameless is pursuing and carrying out Yahweh's laws. That's what the word there means. If you intend to live blamelessly, well, I think a good place to start, is with Paul's personal instructions to Timothy. We're in, jump back to 1 Timothy, in this case, 1 Timothy chapter 4. Just one verse, but this pretty much not only provides us a place to begin, but pretty well sums up what is entailed in living blamelessly. 1 Timothy chapter 4, and look at verse 12. It says, "Let no man despise your youth." Now, I think this is Paul the aged talking like, and many, like my stepfather often did. He'd see somebody my age and talk about him being a young man. did I say stepfather? My father-in-law, excuse me. Didn't have a stepfather. My father-in-law often would say, talk about a young man. Well, the young man was oftentimes in his late 40s, 50s, and maybe even early 60s. And I think Timothy was not such a young man here. In fact, I think there's indication, well, we don't need to go there, but I think that he was, in fact, quite a lot older than what we might normally think of. But anyway, he says, "Let not a man despise thy youth, but be thou an example of the believers in word, in conversation." We're going to talk a little bit more. We'll see that word means something else. King James, back at the King 1611 time, conversation meant something totally different. Otherwise, it seems very redundant to talk about in word and in conversation. But it says, "In word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, and in purity." Let me read it to you from the New American Standard Bible. "Let no one look down on your youthfulness, but rather in speech, conduct," and that's what conversation meant at that time, "conduct, love, faith, and purity, show yourself an example to those who believe." To those who believe. In other words, Paul was saying, You need to be in the place where you can do as I've told you and others to do, and that is to follow me as I follow Christ, and thereby be blameless. He says, rather in speech, conduct, love, faith, and purity. If you have those handled, and you can show yourself an example, I will guarantee that you are living a pretty blameless life in Christ. Not a perfect, not a sinless life, but a blameless life. And one who probably, whenever it is imperfect and not what it should be, that immediately deals with it. And thus would qualify. If you're a man and old enough and have the other qualifications taken care of to be an elder or leader in the greater ecclesia. All right, well, we've talked about blamelessness. We need to move on. Back to 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2. Again, it says, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. Following blamelessness, the second qualification, and I think these are in order as Yahweh intends them to be. And following blamelessness as the first qualification, the second qualification for official leadership in the ecclesia is that a man must be a husband. Which, in case you haven't figured it out, requires that ecclesiastical leaders, pastors, elders, overseers, bishops, judges, must be men. Enough said. You don't qualify. You can't qualify as a leader in the greater ecclesia unless you're a man. Because only a man can be a husband. Well, maybe not in this day and age. But under God's understanding of it, you gotta be a man. In Paul's list to Titus, once again, we find the same, just as we found blameless as the first qualification in both lists, we find this same list qualification listed second, and he adds the following to it in Titus. Titus chapter 1 and verse 6, he said, if any man be blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly. Let me give you some other versions for the children's part in this, so maybe you get a better idea of what's really being spoken of here. New American Standard says, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. Dissipation is not a word we tend to use, so let's go to the Young's literal translation. It says, having children steadfast, not under accusation of riotous living or insubordinate. The Bible in basic English says, whose children are of the faith, children of whom it may not be said that they are given to loose living or are uncontrolled. Again, I'm sharing these different synonyms and words just to get a real good feeling of what God requires of a leader in the greater ecclesias, in the greater ecclesia, what he requires of them as it concerns his children. Today's English version perhaps expresses it best. It says, and his children must be believers and not have the reputation of being wild or disobedient. How many leaders today, government leaders today, would be disqualified? Not only because you can hardly find any of them that are blameless, at least after they get into office, it seems we find out. In fact, even before they get into office, it seems not to matter in many cases anymore. But even if they were, how many of them are the leaders in their home in such a fashion that their children would not disqualify them? 1 Timothy 3:4 puts the emphasis back where it really needs to be, and thus depicts the man as one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection and gravity. See, the emphasis is not on the children, putting it on them to qualify their father, but on the father to rule his children in such a way that he is not disqualified thereby by the office. One that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. Note, a qualified man, whether you like the term or not, we just read it, is a man who rules his household. rules his household. In other words, neither his wife nor his children rule him. Neither is it a shared rulership. His wife and his children hopefully contribute to his rule, but he alone is the head of his family. Listen, a woman run home, and I'm not going to be popular saying this, but a woman run home is inevitably a one-headed monster. And a two-headed home is a divided monstrosity. Plain and simple. Put simply, if you do not rule your household, you do not qualify for the office of elder, pastor, overseer, or whatever else you want to call it. Now, let's not miss that a part of this qualification is that such a man doesn't just rule. It says he rules well. Not with an iron fist. That is, unless that's required. Now, let's be truthful. Whether politically correct or not, in this day and age of rampant feminism and women's liberation within and without the church, or maybe I should say Christianity, when everything else has failed for the man, sometimes, an iron fist, and I'm not talking about beating your wife, but sometimes there may be times when a quote-unquote iron fist, when laying down the law without equivocation in no uncertain terms, is required for a man to remain a man and to retain his headship. I'll guarantee you in this day and age, there are times when a man, if he's going to remain a man and retain his position, must take the hard line. Just as it is with a man's children. Are there not times that a man has to take the hard line? And sometimes literally, the iron fist, if you will. Are women children? No. Unless they're rebellious and act like a child. And any woman who's rebellious to her husband is acting like a rebellious child. The fact is, when it comes to husbands' God-given authority, very few wives are not going to test that authority, much the same as children do. It's part and parcel of the curse that was a result of Eve's transgression in Genesis chapter 3. In fact, listen to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16. And I'm going to add just two words in this, but I believe it's the right interpretation, particularly concerning the context and how one word in particular is used just one chapter later. Genesis 3:16, it says, "Unto the woman he said, I will," this is a result of the part of her curse, Yahweh's curse upon her for her rebellion, her sin. And he says, "Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be," I'm going to add two words, "shall be to rule over thy husband, but he shall rule over you." At least some will. I believe that's the correct interpretation. The Hebrew word translated desire there literally means stretching after. And it's the same Hebrew word translated desire in Genesis 4:7, where we find the following. It says, "If thou," speaking to Abel, "doeth well, shall thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, His desire to do what? To rule over him. And then he follows it up with almost the same statement as Eve was told, and thou shall rule over him. And so I don't think it was just a desire toward having a husband. I think it was a desire there in Genesis 3:16. For the woman, it was a part of the curse that she was going to desire to rule over her husband. Therefore, because since the fall, I believe it is inherent in women to, at the very least, test the boundaries. Sometimes men, it's necessary for a man to take the tough stand, to simply lay down the law. In other words, this is the way it's going to be, like it or not. However, there's a caveat to all of that. If a man is ruling well, is generally ruling well, leading, by example, chivalrously loving his wife and his children as he does himself, taking such a stand will be the exception rather than the rule. Unless, of course, you've chosen a wife who really does not intend to be submissive to Yahweh, and therefore has no inclination toward ever being submissive to you either. Young man, choose your wives well. I think that this is actually where Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 9 comes into play. Proverbs 21 verse 9, where it says, it is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop, corner of an attic, than it is with a brawling woman in a wide house. Interpreted, at least in the sense of what we're talking about, interpreted, it is better for you to retain your manhood and have to isolate yourself than to lose your manhood to retain a happy home. The fact is that far too many men have sacrificed their headship on the altar of their wives' happiness. Lost their headship, having been convinced that they must always, under all circumstances, be the nice guy. Sometimes, every man wants his wife happy. Once married, there's hardly anything he wants more than that. Everyone wants a peaceful home. But regrettably, some men want it so bad, they're willing to sacrifice their headship on it. They're willing to give in, when in fact they should remain strong despite the outcome in such circumstances. Turn to Exodus. I added this because I know people have read this, Exodus chapter 4. I know people have read this and wonder, what in the world is going on here? But I think this plays into exactly what we're talking about here. Exodus chapter 4. You ever wondered, here is Moses. He's had the burning bush experience. He's headed back now. I don't know how far between Midian and Egypt, but he's on his way back to deliver the Israelites. He's got his wife and his two boys with him. And in the middle of his going back, we find these three verses kind of just stuck in there with hardly any explanation whatsoever. In fact, you've really got to read between the lines to really get, I think, an understanding of what's going on. And I'm sure people all the time read this and think, oh, what in the world is that about? Exodus chapter 4, let's begin reading with verse 24. It says, and it came to pass by the way, as they were headed back to Egypt, and it came to pass by the way in the inn that Yahweh met him, speaking of Moses, and sought to kill him. Now this is the guy that he's just weeks probably earlier spoke through the burning bush and said, you're the deliverer. You're the man that's going back to Egypt. You're the man I've chosen. And now he's en route, fulfilling his commission, or en route to fulfill his commission. And it tells us that God meets him in the way and intends to kill him. And then it says, then Zipporah, his wife, took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet and said, surely a bloody husband art thou to me. So he let him go. Then she said, a bloody husband thou art because of the circumcision. That's it. Now, I know people have read that and thinking, what in the world is going on here? Well, I'll tell you what I think is going on here, is that all of a sudden, God puts Moses to the test. And being that one of the requirements for Moses was that he had to have his house in order, and because obviously he hadn't fulfilled what needed to be done already with those sons and circumcising them, all of a sudden they're at the inn, and I think there is one whale of a row going on between his husband and his wife. And she's probably told him, Moses, I'm not about to do that to my son. You can't make me do that to my son. And Moses was put in a place where he had to choose between Yahweh and between Zipporah. He had to get his own house in order before he could be the man that God intended him to be. Because he had not circumcised the boys previously, God says, you're either going to do it or I'm going to kill you. Zipporah or not, happy home or not. And in fact, we know from other passages that Zipporah headed back to daddy. I wouldn't be surprised that Moses said, listen, you're either going to submit or you're going back to your daddy. And he chose he chose Yahweh over his wife. Moses himself had to get his home in order. And had he not, had he sacrificed, had he said, okay, man, Zipporah, I want a happy wife and I want a happy home, he'd have never been the man that God would have used. And in fact, God would have killed him right there. Moses was not about to sacrifice his manhood, his headship, on the altar of his wife's happiness. There came a time when Moses said, listen, I'm laying down the line. I'm laying down what needs to be done regardless. You know, I'm sure he pleaded with her. I'm sure he tried to love her into doing and to understanding and to accepting it. It finally came to a point where he said, it's this way or the highway, gal. And finally, I think, either she just packed up and left, or he sent her packing back to daddy. Now, having said all of that, while it is for a man to be the head of his home, his wife is to be his queen, and his children are to be his prince and princes and princesses, and should be treated as such. On the other hand, as queens and princes and princesses in subjection to their king, or they should be in subjection to their king, with their primary goal, the success of his headship. Now, back to 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4. Again, it says, one that ruleth well in his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. Now, we need to talk about what that does not mean. Here's what that does not mean. It does not mean that the man must have perfectly obedient children at all times. If that is what is meant, then no one would ever qualify, plain and simple. Children are described by Solomon as having hearts full of foolishness, and thereby they are inevitably prone to disobedience, usually evident within the first few months of life. Consequently, this is not a qualification of perfection any more than blamelessness requires absolute perfection. Instead, what we need to look for is a man who is diligent about driving the foolishness and disobedience out of his children. And how is that accomplished? The Bible illiterate man is bound to ask. Proverbs 22:15. It says, foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of correction will drive it out of him. The rod of correction. He's got to be a man who's diligent. In other words, in that regard, in other words, a man qualified for official leadership is a man who beats his children. And in this case, literally so. May not be literally so with his wife, but in this case, it's literally so. Within reason and limits, and of course, only when required. Proverbs 23:13-14, it says, withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with a rod, he shall not die. I want you to look into the congregation here. You'll see my four children, and they're still living. And I'm here to tell you, they got some real beatings when it was required and within limits. It says, thou shalt beat him with the rod and shall deliver his soul from hell. That is a non-optional biblical instruction and part and parcel of ruling your household well. And thus, any man who does not use the rod of correction on his rebellious children. I mean, this is where this goes to. Any man who does not, who refuses, who thinks it's better to stand them in the corner or who knows whatever else Dr. Spock and his ilk has come up with, is not qualified as an elder in the ecclesia. Now, will the rod of reproof produce perfect children? Hardly. Look at my children. They're pretty close to perfect, but they ain't perfect any more than their daddy is. But it will produce well-behaved, respectful children. And any time you find children who are not well-behaved and respectful, it is a sure bet that they have negligent fathers, particularly, who don't love their children enough to apply the Board of Education on their little fat fannies. Proverbs 13:24, he who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. On the other hand, the man who refrains from doing so, he's a man who is more interested in his own immediate popularity with his wife and his children than he is with the long-term future of his child. The fact is, a man can hide some things about himself. Probably not nearly as much as he thinks he can. Most people can see through us pretty well. But there are some things a man can hide about himself. But it's impossible for a father to conceal whether he is a man who disciplines and is thus in control of his children or not. That is, unless he never lets them out in public. Which, if you're not diligently disciplining them, you'll wish you could lock them up until they're past 20 or more. If your children, we're going to have to close this. We'll have more to deal with in this particular qualification in the next message. But if your children are a continual embarrassment to you in public, there's going to be exceptions. I could name you a few with my children, and I know that Linda certainly could as well. But they're exceptions. But if your children are a continual embarrassment every time you take them out, or almost every time you take them out into publics, is itself indicative that your home is not in order, and that whatever they are in public, they're almost assuredly, at least as adolescents and teenagers, probably much far worse at home. You may be able to lie about yourself and get away with it. But your children are living testimonies. And thus, I think, part of the reason for the qualification. But they are living testimonies who will inevitably reflect your headship or lack thereof. And your qualification in this particular area as a leader in the greater ecclesia. Again, we'll have more to deal with this. I don't think too much more, but there's still some things to be said. In fact, there's still some things we need to deal with about what this qualification is not, because there is some definite misunderstandings. Some men whom some would like to disqualify on this particular count who should not be disqualified. In fact, the very thing they would like to disqualify them over is the proof that they are qualified, in fact, instead. So we'll deal with that in the next message. Let's stand. We'll go ahead and close today. Heavenly Father, we come before you, Lord, once again, very thankful to you for your love and mercies, for your continual patience and guidance for all of us, Lord. And it's for all of us to figure out, Father, where we fall short, for we all do, in being as blameless as you or in any other area, Lord, where we may fall short, that it is up to us, it is incumbent upon us to discover those areas, and Lord, to not just simply ignore them, to brush them, to sweep them under the brush them away or sweep them under the carpet, but to actually address them in our lives and to become what you want us to be, regardless the price that sometimes has to be paid. Guide us men, particularly in being men, Lord, not wimps, not under the submission of our children and our wives, but the men whom they so desperately need for us to lead and to do so by example and chivalrous love, to do so by sacrifice, Lord, but also to take the position on it that we need to when it needs to be taken. Guide us in the wisdom to be able to know how to balance that delicate situation and to be the men first that you intend us to be and that our wives and children so desperately need us to be and that the body of Christ needs us as to be as well. We ask this, we praise you now in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.